Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The Appalachian Regional Commission aims to grow entrepreneurship.
8 out of every 10 students indicates that they want to own a business. 8 out of 10.
The Gulf Coast provides a hint of what good and bad can come from a cracker plant planned for Pennsylvania.
The house shook, and I got up and I went to the door.
A look at just what goes on into making Tennessee moonshine.
That's where we cook the corn mash. We have to heat it up to 200 degrees. It releases all the starch out of the corn.
And one West Virginia man tackles the problem of profound poverty.
And tackle what I believe is the leading contributor to the proliferation of terrorism and insurgency and kind of general global instability, which is extreme poverty.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Growing entrepreneurship. That was the focus of the Appalachian Regional Commission's annual conference that took place this past week in Charleston, West Virginia. From access to capital to forming networks, members from 13 states shared their experiences and ideas on how to create an environment that will encourage entrepreneurs to start to grow their businesses. But as West Virginia Public Radio's Ashton Mara reports, many agreed it starts with education.
By the federal definition, 97% of the businesses located in West Virginia are classified as small businesses with less than 200 employees. 70% have less than 20 employees, which Commerce Secretary Keith Burdett says is very telling of West Virginia's business climate.
Small business is big business in West Virginia.
Burdett and his staff joined business owners, nonprofits, and educators from the ARC member states at the annual conference, which was hosted this year by the only state to fully lie in the region. This year's theme, entrepreneurship, transforming Appalachia's economy. Earl Gohl is the ARC's federal co-chair.
We had practitioners, people who in their own communities work very hard to provide technical assistance, to provide education, to provide capital, and provide incubation services, to have a discussion about what it is they do, what works for them, to share their ideas with other parts of Appalachia.
The purpose, Gohl says, is to discuss and share ideas centered on how to make Appalachia a viable environment for entrepreneurs.
In my work, it seems like everyone has a small business they run out of the back of their truck or out of the garage or out of the shed. And the challenge that we have is provide the environment where those folks can succeed and where those folks can grow.
The conference hosted a number of strategy sessions discussing how to create value chains with local businesses, how to gain access to capital and startup money, and this session, called Real World Ready, focused on embedding entrepreneurial lessons in public and higher education.
8 out of every 10 students indicates that they want to own a business. 8 out of 10. Now here's the correlating problem. They want to own their business, they want to be an entrepreneur, but they've not taken courses or had support systems at the school in order to help them become an entrepreneur. There's something wrong with that equation.
Again, Keith Burdett.
West Virginia has always been a state of small business people and entrepreneurs. And so we know they've got the motivation. And the issue is how do we give them the skills to be successful?
Burdett says education is the key, but as the session's moderator, Ron Thomas, points out, he serves as vice president of the National Association for Community College Entrepreneurship. It's not always that easy.
We have all these now requirements for students to be able to graduate, science, math, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you got to get a little creative.
Thomas says the way to do that is to embed entrepreneurial lessons into courses students already have to take and start doing it at an early age to grow creative, business-minded thinkers from kindergarten up. Burdett says that's something the state is trying to do.
It's an essential step. We're doing more in both public schools and higher education, but we've still got a long way to go.
Statewide programs like Lemonade Day have elementary school students learning how to start their own businesses with lemons, sugar, and water, while more focused programs like those on West Virginia University's Parkersburg campus have classroom teachers calling staff meetings with their students in conference rooms and hosting trade shows where students can show off their products. Gull says it's never too early and it's never too late to start thinking like an entrepreneur. And these types of programs, where students are taking an active part in not just their education, but in their communities, are the key to creating that essential environment to support an entrepreneurial spirit into the future.
The challenge in developing entrepreneurs in local communities is really about collaboration, being willing to reach out and partner with folks and organizations that you don't usually partner with. And it's those collaborations that end up producing real results. What people find out is they can do much more working together than they can by working by themselves.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
Meanwhile, higher education in West Virginia continues to feel a financial strain because of budget cuts. Forums that took place in some southern counties this past week focused on those cuts. As West Virginia Public Radio's Clark Davis reports, the forums allowed legislators to hear new ideas on how colleges and universities plan to deal with them.
State legislators Kevin Craig, Kelly Sabonia, Carol Miller, and Jim Morgan of Cabell County and Don Perdue of Wayne County were on hand to share their thoughts on possible budget cuts for state colleges and universities. This fiscal year, higher education institutions in West Virginia underwent a 7.5% cut to their state budget appropriations and have been asked to submit budgets reflecting cuts of another 7.5% or up to 8.3% for next year. Ideas for changes range from dipping into the state's rainy day fund, which sits at nearly $1 billion, or creatively taxing items that have never been taxed before, such as internet downloads of music, movies, and books, and closing loopholes that allow online travel companies to book hotel rooms at reduced tax rates. Delegate Kevin Craig says he understands the rainy day fund looks appealing because it's starting to rain.
Everybody thinks it's a good idea to have a rainy day fund. Exactly how much do you need in it is the question. How do you best utilize those funds? But I agree, it's raining.
According to legislators, they may need to look more individually at where cuts should come from. Craig says so far this fiscal year, the state is running 4% behind on tax collections, much of which is contributed to a struggling coal economy. Jim Morgan says there is also a decline in revenue from the reduction of the corporate income tax and the elimination of the food sales tax. Perdue says the way out may be through tax hikes. Others like Delegate Sabonia aren't sure new taxes are the answer. She wants to carefully look at where money is currently being spent.
We want to make sure that every dollar, every dime of taxpayer dollars is being utilized in an efficient and effective manner.
Student Jaron Johnson says he felt the legislators took his and other students' ideas seriously, and ultimately the crowd will have to wait and see how the delegates vote.
I would have liked to have seen a little bit more straightforward. However, the delegates that did come, I felt like they have our best interest in mind, but you're never going to find a politician that's going to say, no, I don't support higher education. So when you have an elected official say that they support it, it's going to, when it goes to casting that vote, that's when we'll see what the real answers were.
Jonathan Gomez is a student from Parkersburg. He says the opportunity to speak directly with legislators was huge.
It was amazing. You can write letters, you can call all you want, but getting that face-to-face contact is what really matters, because they can't avoid you. They have to tell you what they think right there and in there.
Gomez says he understands completely that to get what higher education needs, it might come down to paying more.
The money has to come from somewhere. If you need to raise taxes, that's okay with me. I actually feel that we do need to do that to get what we need, because there's nowhere else the funding is going to come. Gambling money only comes so far, and the turnpike money only comes so far. So the taxes is the only logical way to get it.
Janet Dooley is the Associate Dean for the College of Arts and Media and Program Director for the School of Journalism. She says the response of the legislators was optimistic, but it's going to take time.
This is going to be a slow process. This isn't something that's going to change in March. This is going to be a look strategically at how we're bringing funding into the state. I think March we're still going to be a little bit upset about how things are going, but I think in the long run it can be made better.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
Last year, researchers in West Virginia conducted a survey that provided a snapshot as to how veterans are doing on several levels. The findings were somewhat staggering, as it determined a significant portion of the state's veterans, 20%, were at risk for suicide. West Virginia Public Radio's Ben Aduccio reports on the efforts made since then to help the state's veterans.
The state's veteran population is about 170,000. Last year's study attempted to reach out to veterans of all ages for information about their demographics, healthcare access, and personal information. The study found 50% of the veterans represented were struggling with depression and post-traumatic stress. Joseph Scotty, who wrote the report, is trying to continue the work of helping these veterans. He started a new organization called Whole Veterans, which stands for Welcome Home, Overcoming, Living, Engaging.
Sometimes it's a little bit of like an emergency room triage situation, but there are effective treatments, the most important one being talking about what happened. As hard as that is, it's almost harder to keep it in.
Scotty says it takes a lot of different people, primarily from within one's community, to encourage veterans to reach out for help when they need assistance. He says there simply aren't enough people at the moment to deal with absolutely every veteran who needs care.
PTSD and other mental health disorders are tricky because they get better and worse. You can feel good for a while, then things happen in your life and they get worse, and then they get better again. So it's back and forth, up and down. But in general, if we know this is an at-risk population, we should be doing a lot of things. The VA, the state and private agencies should be doing things to reach out specifically to veterans and their families.
The American Psychiatric Association's guide on how to treat post-traumatic stress disorder has been updated. But Scotty says veterans shouldn't be worried about stricter qualification standards for treatment.
But the research that I have done and others have done around the country shows that basically if you qualified as meeting the diagnosis for PTSD under the prior diagnostic system, the DSM-4. Under the new system, it's very, very likely, 97% chance that you'll also meet the new criteria.
Scotty expects with the study and with a cabinet post in state government to help veterans, positive changes will be made. His next study is geared specifically to hear from Gulf War veterans. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ben Aduccio in Morgantown.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The U.S. Coast Guard is considering a policy change to allow the transport of wastewater from hydraulic fracturing on inland waterways. Oil and gas companies currently move most of their wastewater by truck from the shale fields in Ohio and Pennsylvania to states with lighter storage regulations like Texas and Louisiana. Now companies want to take the river route to save on fuel and personnel costs. But U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant Dan McQuaite says the wastewater could be too risky to move by barge. McQuaite says the chemical makeup of the wastewater could prove disastrous in the event of a spill.
There's reports that some of the stuff has 10 times more salt than salt water. We don't want that getting into the water up here. That could destroy ecosystems, kill plants, on its own.
Meanwhile, an advocacy group for the barge industry says it can transport fracking wastewater both safely and economically. American Waterways Operators spokesperson Ann McCullough says barges are well equipped to move the hazardous wastewater. She says industry is concerned about more than its own safety.
But it's also safety of the public and the environment. When you encapsulate all of this, it really points to a safety culture and a safety record that our industry is very proud of.
A 30-day public comment period on the potential change is open till the end of November. Because of the fracking boom, Shell is thinking about building a large petrochemical plant in Beaver County, Pennsylvania. In Louisiana, the shale gas boom has already led to a renaissance for the state's large chemical industry. What does a chemical building boom look like? In the third of four reports from the Gulf Coast, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier found jobs fueling the chemical boom in Louisiana are abundant, but they can also be dangerous.
On a rainy morning, Mike Eads drives around Geismar, Louisiana. It's about halfway between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, and it's in the middle of Louisiana's so-called Chemical Corridor. It's a 60-mile stretch along the Mississippi River where roughly a quarter of the country's petrochemicals are made. Eads points out several large construction projects at hulking industrial plants. Eads is director of the local development corporation. His job is to bring new business to the area. He pulls over. Workers in the distance are preparing a site for construction.
This is about a 225-acre site.
The site will house two plants for Methanex. Methanex is the world's largest producer of methanol, a basic chemical made from natural gas. The total price for the project is over $1 billion, but the price itself isn't the most eye-popping thing about these new plants.
They are just actually dismantling another plant in Chile and moving it to this area.
Eads has been in this business for 30 years, and he's worked in seven different states. In the last year alone, he's seen about $3.6 billion in new announced projects here.
And that's by far the most that I've ever experienced in my career in any location.
These projects are all happening because of the fracking boom. It's made natural gas cheap and abundant, and chemical companies use natural gas as a raw material. While the boom comes at a good time for the region's economy, people here also know these plants can be dangerous. This fact was driven home one morning in June. Antoinette West was lying on her couch in Geismar.
The house shook, and I got up, and I went to the door.
She thought it was an explosion at a nearby vinyl plant, which caught fire last year, but she couldn't see any smoke when she looked in that direction. Then she looked behind her trailer.
All I seen was black smoke.
A massive explosion and fire at a chemical plant rocks the Geismar.
It was the Williams Olefins plant in Geismar. One worker died in the explosion, and another died the next day from his injuries. Over 100 were hurt. The plant makes ethylene and propylene. It's the same kind of plant, an ethane cracker, that Shell Chemical is proposed building in western Pennsylvania. Ethylene and propylene are the building blocks of plastic and other chemicals. They're also highly flammable. The company said a rupture in a heat exchanger caused the explosion. For West, it was another moment where she wished she didn't have to live so close to a chemical plant.
If I could move today, I would move. I'm not gonna lie. I would get out of here.
But this is the only place she can afford. The company reported releasing 31,000 pounds of chemicals in the blast, mostly propylene, which can burn the eyes and skin. But the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, the state regulator, said that its air monitoring taken that day showed no unsafe levels of chemicals in the air near the plant. Leroyal Ely lives two doors down from West. He's an electrician who's worked in many of the plants in the area. As his family gets ready for dinner one night, he says he isn't worried about air pollution from the explosion.
I didn't think nothing really seriously would happen to me over here. I was worried about the people in there.
But his wife, Elaine Claiborne, says she was concerned about what came out of the plant during the blast.
It might not affect us right now, but later on in the year, yeah, I got concerned.
Ely says worries about pollution or explosions are just something you have to live with if you live near a chemical plant. He says, overall, it's worth it.
It's good to have them, but it's a risk in everything.
Those risks are why the industry needs stronger oversight, says Kim Nyberger. He's with the United Steelworkers, which represents thousands of chemical and refinery workers.
Take a coffee can and fill it about half full of gas and put it on your barbecue. That's not much different than what's going on in these facilities. It's a dangerous, dangerous operation.
The Obama administration is paying closer attention to the issue of chemical safety. In August, the president signed an executive order mandating greater communication and enforcement among federal agencies who oversee chemical plants. He was responding to a fertilizer explosion in April in West Texas. That blast killed 15. Despite high-profile explosions, the chemical manufacturing industry is comparatively safe, according to records from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. The industry has a fatality rate roughly half the national average for other industries. And it's much, much safer than jobs like mining, forestry, or farming. But Nyberger says those numbers can be deceiving.
No, I think the industry is more dangerous than it seems.
That's because those injury and fatality rates don't always include contractors working at the plant. When those are accounted for, he says, those injury numbers are actually higher. But an industry trade group says even if outside workers are taken into account, the chemical sector is relatively safe, and it's getting safer. The American Chemistry Council says its members have had a precipitous drop in accidents, 58% since the 1990s. Scott Jensen of the Chemistry Council says those numbers include contractors.
While I think in the public's mind that there is a renewed focus on safety, I think for our industry, that focus has always been there.
Concern over safety issues aren't likely to stop the chemical expansion anytime soon. In Geismar, the plants keep growing to take advantage of cheap shale gas. And they're attracting workers like Joshua Gray. Gray moved here from Baton Rouge to work as a carpenter. On a recent afternoon, he stopped in a parking lot on his way out of a laundromat.
The economic part of it is outstanding. The money's here. There's no reason to leave here. I mean, you're going to make some money right here. For the next 10 years, it's equivalent to a gold rush.
Gray was with Josh Gibbons, an 18-year-old from Baton Rouge. Last week, Gibbons was delivering pizzas. Now he's working as a carpenter's apprentice.
Learn. I'm there for learning, really. I'm there for the money, but I mean, it's not that great at the moment.
What's the money like now?
14 an hour starting right now, but it's the first time in a plant.
18 years old.
But
you can't beat it, you know. He was delivering pizzas a week ago. Now he's making
checks a week.
$140 a day.
The irony of all this for Joshua Gray is he's not really in favor of the expansion. He thinks the plants are releasing too much air pollution and that they're bad for the environment.
I know I don't really in favor of none of it. It's not good for the environment. It's really terrible. But, you know, when you need a job, you're going to do what you got to do to make money.
And Gray says he'll be here as long as the money keeps coming. In Geismar, Louisiana, I'm Reed Frazier for the Allegheny Front.
This project is supported in part by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. In his final report next week, Reed Frazier looks at how one Louisiana town is reacting to a plant similar to the one Shell proposes building in Beaver County. Grassroots opponents of a proposed natural gas liquids pipeline gathered last week in Frankfort, Kentucky, to ask Governor Steve Beshear to block the project. About 40 people delivered a printed version of an online petition that received more than 36,000 signatures from across the nation. Kentucky Public Radio's Jonathan Meador reports that for many advocates, the issue is as much about spirituality as it is about the environment.
Thank you to all who are here this morning and welcome.
The Bluegrass Pipeline would carry natural gas liquids from drilling operations in the northeastern United States through central Kentucky into the Gulf of Mexico for processing into consumer products. The rally was largely comprised of religious organizations from across the state and their concern that the pipeline and the potential devastation it could cause should it break would harm what they call God's most sacred gift, the earth itself. Pastor David Whitlock of Lebanon Baptist Church was among the protesters.
We've ravaged the land, we've permanently scarred it, we have desecrated a sacred gift from God, and as part of the faith community, we today are simply here to say enough is enough.
After the group delivered the petition to Beshear's secretary, they broke into a rendition of the Christian hymn, For the Beauty of the Earth. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Meador.
Fracking has unleashed a huge amount of natural gas in Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale, which has rapidly become one of the most productive gas fields in the world. But like every industry, it responds to supply and demand. Overproduction has led to a glut of gas, causing companies to shift operations to different parts of the state in search of more lucrative natural gas liquids. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Kusick has more on the ebb and flow of the industry and how it's affecting the state's economy.
There's a bustling Friday lunch crowd at the Bullfrog Brewery in downtown Williamsport. Sarah Yates is tending bar. She's watched as the industry's grown in her hometown.
It's good for Williamsport because it's causing a big boom here for us. Like, we've never had this much business.
Pennsylvania's on track to produce roughly 3 trillion cubic feet of gas this year. That's enough to supply about 10% of what the entire country consumes annually. Industry-funded commercials have often depicted Williamsport's charming downtown as an all-American place that's been transformed by the nearby gas wells.
As you know, success in a town like Williamsport means success for us all.
But if you talk to Mayor Gabriel Campana, he'll be frank. Things have changed.
I would say probably about a little over a year ago, some of the growth that was occurring has receded a bit.
A few months ago, he even sold his car, a Honda Civic that runs on compressed natural gas. He had trouble finding places to fuel it up.
I personally thought it was going to move a little bit faster, that we would see stations on 80, et cetera, in a much faster time.
The main reason for the slowdown here is simple: supply and demand. Overproduction caused the price to plummet. But not all gas is created equal, and business has picked up elsewhere. The so-called dry gas around Williamsport isn't as profitable as the wet gas found out near Pittsburgh and into Ohio and West Virginia. It naturally contains more lucrative gas liquids. And as the drilling rush has shifted, Republican Governor Tom Corbett is facing a tough re-election, and he's promoting the industry as an overall success story in his commercials.
And the benefits to Pennsylvanians has been remarkable. Not only is the Marcellus Shale natural gas industry supporting over 200,000 jobs, it's resulted in over $400 million returned to local communities for local projects.
I think that the story being told by both sides is not accurate.
Tim Kelsey is a professor at Penn State who's been analyzing the economics of the gas boom. He says the story of shale gas and Pennsylvania's economy is nuanced.
People who say it's really wonderful, people who say it's really bad, in reality, it's between the two.
The 200,000 jobs cited in Corbett's commercial include two categories: core and ancillary industries. According to the most recent state figures, about 28,000 people work directly in oil and gas. The rest are ancillary, which means everyone who works in, say, the trucking industry or road construction gets counted, whether they have anything to do with gas or not. The other figure in the commercial is the $400 million brought in through the impact fee. And the gas industry's also brought in about $1.7 billion in corporate taxes since the boom began. And Corbett's energy executive, Patrick Henderson, points out it can be hard to quantify other ripple effects in the economy, like lower natural gas prices.
If you can lower the cost of energy, which is a prime contributor to any business's budget, you're going to increase your competitiveness.
But when you talk about new wealth coming into communities where drilling is happening, Penn State professor Tim Kelsey says royalties are a bigger deal than jobs. In the first 3 years of the boom, he found income related to royalties went up by about $1.5 billion. But lately, a few companies have been accused of underpaying people. Retiree Mary Jane Folster says her monthly royalty check has dwindled because the gas company is charging her for the expenses it incurs processing and transporting the gas.
What bothers me is that I am being cheated.
But bottom line, Tim Kelsey says what matters most is the long-term economic outlook. The gas will be gone at some point. So will this new wealth be wisely invested? And what kind of costs, like environmental damage, is Pennsylvania incurring?
And so far, economists and the state and others have been largely identifying the benefits, and there's been very little attention paid to the overall costs.
When it comes to making the gas companies pay for those costs, an old debate is reemerging as the race for governor heats up. Governor Corbett promotes the status quo, where companies pay an impact fee for every well they drill. His leading Democratic challenger, Congresswoman Allison Schwartz, argues that's not enough. She wants to add a new production tax on top of that to fund various needs across the state, including education and transportation projects. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania, Williamsport, Lycoming County.
The Three Rivers Film Festival is taking place this weekend in Pittsburgh. One of the films scheduled portrays the history of the environmental movement from the founding of the Sierra Club to the current concerns of climate change. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant spoke with filmmaker Mark Kitchell about his film, A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining us. A Fierce Green Fire, it's an interesting title. Where does that come from?
Well, it's a story of awakening by one of the great pioneers, Aldo Leopold. In the early 1900s, he was a young forest ranger. He instinctively shot a wolf, and then they ran down the hill to see and saw a fierce green fire in the dying wolf's eyes, and that was his awakening. He realized that that wolf knew more about the order of things and the connectedness than he did. We tell that story in the film, but we also use the title to talk about the movement.
In the film, there are some other moments like this. You know, a couple of the guys from Greenpeace describe looking at the whale's eye.
That's Paul Watson and Rex Weiler. And it's one of the wonderful things about the film is the way they sort of tag team that story from the first whaling campaign.
As this whale lay and rolled in agony on the surface of the ocean, I caught his eye and he looked straight at me.
And we're looking into the eye of this huge sperm whale, and I have to tell you, it's sort of beyond emotional. You know, there's certain moments that are so emotional, you're just in brand new territory.
Why were the Russians killing these whales? You know, they didn't eat sperm whale meat, but they did use the spermaceti oil to make high heat-resistant lubricating oil for machinery. And one of the pieces of machinery that they used it in is the manufacture of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I said, here we are destroying this incredibly beautiful, intelligent, socially complex creature for the purpose of making a weapon meant for the mass destruction of humanity. And that's when I came to me with a, you know, like a flash, we're insane. We're just totally insane. And from that moment on, I decided that I work for whales, I work for seals, I work for sea turtles and fish and seabirds. I don't work for people.
As someone who's heard about all these things but never really quite understood all the stories, one thing with the film is it really explains each of these stories. You hear the term Love Canal and you have a sense of what happened there, but not, I mean, to hear it kind of told in this comprehensive way.
That's the best single story in the film, and one that is really surprising how few people know that story, including me.
When did the state tell you to stop growing your vegetable garden?
In August of 78.
So they weren't willing to move you out, but they were willing to tell you to stop growing vegetables.
Willing to tell us not to have the kids go barefooted, not to have them go in the basement, don't plant a garden, but enjoy your house. Live there with your family while we continue doing our tests and use you as guinea pigs.
And we found that 56% of the children in our community were born with birth defects.
The movie takes us from Lois Gibbs and the residents of Love Canal taking EPA officials hostage to the social justice and environmental fight of Chico Mendes in Brazil, and then all the way through today and the issue of climate change. And we've been talking with director Mark Kitchell. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, and hello to Pittsburgh. I'm thrilled that we're getting to show the film there at last.
That's the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant talking to filmmaker Mark Kitchell. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. In Kentucky, there's a bourbon trail, and across Appalachia, there are wine regions and a resurgence of spirit making of all sorts. Moonshine, once the bane of tax collectors and the boon of scofflaws, is now not only legal but popular. Since Tennessee legalized the stuff in 2009, moonshine has been popping up in liquor stores and spawning a small but growing tourism industry. But what is it that makes moonshine moonshine? WUOT's Christine Jessel went to Tennessee Hill Country to find out.
Steve Bosch is a master distiller at Davy Crockett's Tennessee Whiskey in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. University of Tennessee Professor Emeritus Dr. Jamie Adcock has spent a lifetime studying chemistry. Together, they'll walk us through the process of making moonshine.
Kind of noisy in the background with the still going. Over here we have our 400-gallon cooker. That's where we cook the corn mash. We have to heat it up to 200 degrees. It releases all the starch out of the corn so we can convert it to sugar and the yeast can eat it and make alcohol.
The yeast begins to eat, in a sense, the carbohydrate or the sugar and convert it into energy. To get the energy it needs, it will generate heat and it will produce carbon dioxide and ethanol.
Ethanol is the product you want. That's the drinkable product. There's several different types of alcohol that are made during the fermentation process. Methanol, butanol, hexanol, propanol. The only good one you want is ethanol. I'm sure everybody's heard stories of people going blind from drinking moonshine, and that was the methanol.
And methanol can cause liver damage, can damage your retina, make you go blind, kill you. So unless a distiller, a moonshiner, is very careful, you can get a very bad product.
So of course, when you first start the still, the strip and run, which is what we're doing right now, when you first start your strip and run, your methanol and your bad alcohols are going to be the first ones to come off the still. So you want to take the first, depending on your size, couple gallons maybe, and just discard it because it's not any good.
Moonshiners didn't have the blending. They didn't put it into charcoal barrels. They didn't age it to get a blend that had the flavor that makes it Jim Beam or Jack Daniel's. And they just basically produced a clear, colorless liquid and sold that.
It's the same basic process that's been used for hundreds of years, but everybody has their own little quirks, their little processes they go through. And the small things make a big difference in the taste. How fast you distill it, how fast you cool the vapor down. Anytime you distill, it evaporates the alcohol, but it also carries across a certain amount of water and a certain amount of impurities.
You can't get pure ethanol by simple distillation. It comes out as a mixture with water.
That was one of the questions. I said, okay, well, it's an ethanol alcohol. And everybody's like, well, can you drive with it? And the answer, in short, is no.
Not directly. If you put hooch in your gas tank, you will have a problem.
Okay, so no Thunder Road with moonshine in the back.
A bottle of whiskey is not going to do you.
That was Davy Crockett's Tennessee Whiskey Master Distiller Steve Bosch and UT Chemistry Professor Emeritus Dr. Jamie Adcock. I'm Christine Jessel.
This past Wednesday was the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Droop Mountain, which took place on November 6, 1863 in Pocahontas County, West Virginia. Dan Schultz of the Traveling 219 Project covered the sesquicentennial events held at the Battlefield State Park, including the final of four hikes commemorating the battle.
Samuel Bowden, Edward Doyle.
The names of Union and Confederate soldiers killed in battle 150 years ago were read today at Droop Mountain Battlefield State Park. A new monument to the battles fallen was unveiled and dedicated at the sesquicentennial anniversary of what was arguably the most significant battle to take place in West Virginia during the Civil War. The memorial event included an honor guard of reenactors, speakers such as historian Terry Lowry, and the reading of a message from Governor Earl Ray Tomlin in memorial of the battle. The event followed the final of four memorial hikes, organized and led by Droop Mountain Battlefield State Park Superintendent Mike Smith, a 27-mile hike that followed the route of Confederate soldiers to the battle 150 years ago.
My name's Caleb Skaggs. I'm 19 from Rupert, West Virginia.
Caleb Skaggs was one of the 15 participants who hiked the 27 steep and windy miles along U.S. Route 219 from Lewisburg to Droop Mountain. The hike left Lewisburg at around 2 in the afternoon on Tuesday and arrived at the battlefield after 1 a.m. that night.
It was an excellent walk. Took us every bit of about 11 and a half hours to do the walk. For the most part, we were blessed to have some decent weather to march in. I'm pretty worn out, pretty sore.
A number of the hikers, including Caleb, are Civil War reenactors.
I am wearing a gray Confederate uniform. I usually fall in with Brian's Battery out of Lewisburg. But as a reenactor, I wanted to participate, not only because it's important that we keep the history alive, but also my great-great-great-great-grandfather actually participated in the walk with Eccles Brigade 150 years ago to the day.
For Allegheny Mountain Radio and AlleghenyMountainRadio.org, I'm Dan Schultz.
The story was produced by Dan Schultz of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with support from the West Virginia Humanities Council, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and AmeriCorps Vista. For more information, visit traveling219.com. World-class artwork will soon be sold at Lexington's Keeneland Racetrack. It's the first-ever sporting art auction featuring 174 lots focusing on sporting paintings and sculptures by British and American artists. The auction itself takes place November 20th, but Lexington Herald Leader culture reporter Rich Copley says the art is currently on display.
You know, as far as anyone can remember in Lexington, this is the most valuable collection of art that has been brought together for auction in Lexington. You have pieces by Cassatt and Wyeth and other artists that are valued in the millions of dollars. There are about three pieces that really top that price range, and we just, you know, aren't quite used to that level of art being auctioned here. But then there are also quite a number of pieces that are less expensive than that. In 174 lots, there's a lot of really great sporting art, and that's kind of the emphasis of this show.
Meanwhile, Lexington's gay community, its history, and its culture are the focus of another art exhibit that's underway at Transylvania University. Copley says, "I'll Be Your Mirror" runs through November 25th.
And it's sort of a look back at really all the way through the 20th century to Sweet Evening Breeze, who is kind of a icon of Lexington gay culture, going through folks like Henry Faulkner and a real early 70s movement, sort of when the gay pride movement started to really take root up to today.
And another art show planned for Lexington is already generating buzz. As an opening act, Copley says, an artist this week is painting a downtown mural.
Next weekend, we have the Prohibition Festival coming up at Bustard's Billiards and Backroom. But as sort of a prelude to that, a mural is being painted this week on the back of the Kentucky Theater.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. West Virginia University's Festival of Ideas is a lecture series that brings newsmakers, public figures, and thought leaders to campus to engage the community in important issues of the day. Recently, the festival featured Jake Harriman, who talked about extreme poverty in the world and his mission to end it. West Virginia Public Radio's Glynis Board spoke with Harriman about the organization, what influenced him to found it, and what he hopes to accomplish. A warning, the story contains descriptions of wartime events.
Nuru is the Kiswahili word for light, and it connotes hope. Jake Harriman created the organization at Stanford University, and he says he's just a few years away from being able to definitively demonstrate how to end poverty.
I believe that our civilization is at a crossroads. Either we continue destroying each other, or we make the connection that the only chance we have to see the end of terrorism is to end extreme poverty.
That's Jake Harriman in an online video that introduces the goals of Nuru. In a talk at WVU, Harriman shared lessons he's learned in his campaign to end poverty in the world. But first, let's define the beast.
One of the things that Nuru is trying to do is actually change the whole conversation about extreme poverty. The classic definition, according to the World Bank, is living on less than $1.25 a day. But a lot of my background and experiences that I saw in when I was in combat and the desperation and hopelessness in the eyes of the folks that I was working with and sometimes fighting didn't seem to match up with just that strictly economic definition.
Harriman says his definition of extreme poverty is a condition where people are unable to make meaningful choices to secure their basic human rights. He experienced people stuck in these conditions firsthand when he was a Marine. He says it was one experience in particular at the beginning of the Iraq War that changed his life's trajectory. Now, a warning, this next part gets quite graphic and may not be suitable for children or those with delicate dispositions.
I looked up the main avenue of approach on Highway 7 and I saw a little white car coming toward our position. And I thought, they packed explosives in the car, they're going to try to blow themselves up in our position. So I grabbed a couple of my guys and we took off running toward the car to try to get it to stop, and it wasn't stopping, so I fired a warning shot across the hood of the car. It finally stopped about 50 meters out.
It should be noted here that Harriman and his colleagues hadn't eaten in a couple of days. They were sleep deprived and terrified, common wartime circumstances.
The driver jumped out, started waving his arms frantically and sprinting at us. And I think, okay, this guy's strapped bomb to himself. He's going to try to blow himself up. So I'm yelling at him in Arabic to try to get him on the ground. He's not responding. So I pick up my weapon. I think I'm going to have to take him out. And I look behind him, and I see a large black military truck roll up behind his little white car. And six guys in black ran up to his car and started shooting into his car. And this man stopped dead in his tracks, started screaming, and turned around and started sprinting back to his car. And that's when I realized what was happening. This guy was one of those poor farmers trying to escape across our lines with his family. And so I yelled at my guys to tell them to take the fedayeen out as I sprinted to try to save this guy's family. But by the time I got there, it was too late. His wife was in the passenger side. She'd been shot in the face and in the chest, and she was slumped over dead. And he had a little infant baby girl in the back. Her arm had been shot off, and she'd been shot in the head. She was dead, and then he was cradling the little body of his little six-year-old girl who'd been shot in the stomach, and she was choking on her own blood. And this guy was, beside himself. And for the first time in the war, everything slowed down for me, and I put myself in this guy's shoes, and I thought, I live in a world of choices. Where do I want to go to school? What do I want to have for breakfast? Where do I want my kids to grow up? What choices did this guy have when he woke up this morning?
Harriman explained that southern Iraq was one of the poorest areas in the world at the time. A lot of hunger, no access to health care, water, or education. The Iraq army and Saddam's special forces, the Fedayeen, were retreating to make a final stand in Baghdad, but stopping in these rural areas along the way, telling impoverished farmers that if they would just fight, their children would be looked after.
It's not fair that the GPS coordinates of this guy's birthplace dictated that he had no choices in this world. And so I thought that maybe I can make even more of an impact on the war on terror myself if I got out and tackle what I believe is the leading contributor to the proliferation of terrorism and insurgency and kind of general global instability, which is extreme poverty. And that kind of led me on this quest.
In his talk at West Virginia University, Harriman outlined key lessons he's learned that guide his efforts in impoverished places, lessons that he says are applicable in all areas stuck in poverty. Harriman primarily stresses the importance of leadership and finding leaders within communities. He says it's fundamental if the end goal is to leave a community able to self-sustain. Harriman says after you determine who within the community is already standing, dedicated and committed to the health and well-being of that community, conversations then have to happen about the specific needs in critical areas, hunger, ability to cope with economic shock, preventable disease and death, and access to quality education. Then, Harriman says, it's time to research best practices to form an integrated approach to provide for those specific needs.
And we work with the local leaders to analyze those different solutions. And we kind of analyze them using three sets of criteria around impact, sustainability, and scalability. And then they choose the solutions that will work best in their communities. So there's a lot of ownership there.
Harriman refers to the final step as the sustainability engine.
You have to put something in place that will ensure that the work that you're doing with the community can last. And so that's where we focus on our leadership program to build capacity in leaders, and on our financial engine where we build a diversified, scalable business to fund the work after we're gone.
He's currently touring the U.S., raising funds and awareness to grow his organization.
We want to open source our model. We want to share it with other organizations and governments and train them how to use it so that we can spread the success of this model and the impact of giving more and more people choices more quickly. You know, I have this crazy urgency that I live with every day. You know, every day I wake up and I see that man's eyes, you know, on Highway 7, and it drives me. You know, every day I get out of bed and I'm like, that has got to stop. There's far too much unnecessary death that I've seen in this world, and we can stop it together, you know.
Harriman says he's seen his model work in countries around the world, and he also believes it could help communities right here in Appalachia pull themselves out of poverty. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Ford in Morgantown.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WUOT in Knoxville, Tennessee, the Allegheny Front, State Impact, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky Public Radio. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at our website, wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.